Today is October 18th, 2017, and this is episode number 433 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief, co-founder, co-publisher at TMO.
And I'm Jeff Butts, chief monkey tamer at TMO. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Oh, man, you play me really well.
Thank you.
Really, really well. And I like the title, although I think that title could possibly sometimes apply to – no, never mind. Never mind. So right, yesterday.
Well, you do tame a lot of monkeys at TMO.
I try. Yeah. So yesterday on TDO, right, we were doing a show without Jeff, and Jeff is of course not here this week. He's off right. Gallivanting somewhere around the Pacific Northwest. And who was it? It was me and you and Andrew?
It was the elegant John Martellaro.
It was John Martellaro, of course it was. The gentleman of gentlemen.
Yes.
And we were talking about iPhone addiction, and really we had a lot more to talk about than we had in the space for that show.
Yeah, yeah, we had to cut it short, real short.
And funny enough, it's something that you and I were both itching to talk more about.
Yeah, because it's actually something that I studied a little bit back in grad school. The social and cultural implications of people becoming addicted to their devices.
Right. And we were talking about it from the standpoint of John had written a piece about someone at Business Insider was saying that iPhone addiction is somehow a problem for Apple.
Yeah, they're blaming Apple, of course, but
they said it was a problem for Apple, which, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
No, it's not a problem for Apple because it means Apple gets to sell more devices.
Right. And what we said during yesterday's show, the sort of preamble to this larger discussion, is that that iPhone addiction, a device addiction, information addiction, may well be a problem for society.
Yes.
And for perhaps even for civilization. But it's not a problem for Apple per se. And that's where we wanted to take the conversation a little bit deeper today.
Yep. Yep. Because, I mean, it is almost certainly a problem for society. I mean, we have all of these people that are just engrossed with talking to other people all around the world. And yet, they don't talk to their neighbors. They have no idea who their neighbors are, what their neighbors do, what's going on around them, because they're too focused on what's happening in Belgium or the Philippines or even just a neighboring state.
Yeah, or worse, actually. Let me actually put that in a slightly different context. They're too interested in what's happening over in Twitter.
Yeah.
Right. And I think to a certain extent, we start thinking of the social networks almost as places.
Yep. Twitter and Facebook
in particular. Well, Instagram, Snapchat, WhatsApp, you know, all of the major platforms certainly have their own, you know, community.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Okay. So I have a lot of knee-jerk reactions even to what you just said, and I know that you have a lot more you want to say about this. But let me start off with the fact that the same thing was said about the telephone, and we seem to have survived that. Same thing has been said for the internet per se, and we seem to have survived that. The same thing was absolutely said about AOL.
Mm-hmm.
And back when you remember AOL, LOL.
And I remember, yeah.
And
CompuServe.
Absolutely in CompuServe. Oh my God, all the porn that's available on CompuServe, people are going to be addicted to that stuff. And actually that was true. When I had a business in the 90s doing web development, and someone that we worked with tangentially had a history of being a CompuServe what'd you call them? Did you do CompuServe?
I didn't. I hacked into the university vax.
Of course you did.
Well, you know.
Yeah. You know, because Jeff.
Yeah. No, I tinkered into the university vax.
There we go. That way, hold on. I got to interrupt there, too. I don't think I've ever mentioned this to you. In my novel, which you haven't read, which I'm currently shopping to agents, what we would call hackers today in my future are called tinkers.
Really?
Yes. I've been meaning to tell you this for a long time, because I figured that, you know, 120 years from now, we're not going to still be using the word hacker. So I turned
right
back to the 19th century to find a good term. And settle on tinker.
Well, I like the word tinker because it's like I tinker with things. I don't necessarily master them, although sometimes I end up mastering them.
Sure.
But I tinker a lot.
Sure.
But anyways.
Yeah. So, but ever since you came up with this, I've been thinking about how that plays into my book, and I just never mentioned it to you.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks.
Cool. Yeah. Now, to your point, yes, we survived AOL. Yes, we survived the telephone. However, how many people could carry AOL into a restaurant with them and focus only on AOL and not their own family having dinner with them?
Well, this is true. And you mentioned another – so – My first gut reaction that I mentioned was very much a knee jerk counter argument,
mm-hmm,
or counter data point. But the flip side is that I believe in the importance of community on
yes
a macro and micro level.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I believe very much in the importance of community at the neighborhood level. And certainly in many communities, we are increasingly seeing neighbors who don't know each other. And yeah, that's not all about social networks.
No, you can't blame it all on social networks. I mean, it's the breakdown of the nuclear family. It's the need to work two jobs and just being so busy that when you come home, you're – the way my girlfriend likes to call it, she's peopled out. And she just can't people anymore.
Well, okay. It's also, though, about the increasing wealth divide, the yeah wealth gap, and the concentration of wealth into the hands of ever fewer people, which leads to a greater mobility of all the lower economic strata,
mm-hmm,
the lower homeownership, which is also related to the wealth discrepancy, and of course the reality that today we have an ever more mobile workforce as fewer people have lifetime careers. No one has a lifetime career.
True.
In Silicon Valley, where I live, if you stay 2 or 3 or 4 years at the same place, a lot of times another employer is going to look at you a little askance. Like, why'd you stay there for so long? I mean,
wow,
that's absolutely – it's crazy. There are exceptions to that. I've got another friend that works at Intel. Mm-hmm. And at Intel, this is the weirdest thing. She says that when you meet someone at Intel, they say essentially, "Hi, I'm Brian Chaffin, 17 years.
Ah, Like, so they wear their time as a badge of honor.
As a badge of honor. So much so that it's like following your name. It's the second thing that people say.
Yeah, and that's interesting.
Well, that's weird. that's. I mean, it's great that they actually embrace their longevity. What's the word I'm trying to use?
Longevity.
Longevity. Good Lord. Thank you. It's great that they embrace longevity. It's weird that the culture has arisen so that it's the very second thing you announce. And to anyone coming from the outside who's not used to that, it's weird.
Yeah.
Okay. But they're the exception.
Right.
And Apple is another place where there are a lot of people who have worked for a lot of years and they're very, very, very proud of that. But, you know, with the startup culture and, you know, like everybody's basically looking to, they want to get in on the hot startup. They want that startup to go public or get sold. They want to make money and they want to move on. They don't want to build anything. They don't want to, you know, they're not in, they have no company loyalty, et cetera. So, I mean, you've got all of these factors that are playing into, and again, that's just in Silicon Valley. The rest of the country is an extraordinarily different place. But all of these are things that play into the breakdown of community, and certainly having our heads in our smart devices is a factor, to your point.
Yeah.
But I got to quibble on something, though.
Okay.
You mentioned the breakdown of a nuclear family.
Yeah.
The nuclear family is in and of itself an artificial construct that is an outlier throughout history. History has certainly in Western, I think in around the world, families have been multi-generational. And it was starting in the 50s, maybe the late 40s, after World War II in the United States, when we started getting away from multi-generational families living in one dwelling or living close to each other. And actually having a single generation that's focused in and of itself in a very, very selfish and myopic way.
Yeah.
So okay. I don't know that the breakdown of the nuclear family is necessarily a problem in and of itself, in that I think that the nuclear family itself has been part of the problem in breaking down community.
Oh. Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, I think, and we're getting far afield from what our theoretical topic is. You know, it's how we roll here on ACM.
Well, yeah. Did we have one?
Yeah, we do, theoretically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, put together by top men. And I think that we need to find a way to redefine family yet again. I don't see going back to a multi-generational, although you do see some multi-generational. You certainly have adults living with their family more and more.
Right.
Right. That's happening again.
I think you see that more often with divorcees who are single parents. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does make sense. I think that one way that at some point in the future we will, unless civilization breaks down completely, is to actually look at multi-partner family agreements. Be it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I think that polygamy not defined as a patriarchal way of a man having multiple wives only, but in like, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 people coming together where 1 or 2 people are raising kids and the rest of them are the rest of them are working. They may not even all be involved with each other except for the household and kid rearing. I know it's going to make one skin crawl. It's like the thing is that society as we know it is what family has been throughout most of recorded history has been an ignorant woman without rights at home, taking care of family and home. And true. And we have thankfully gotten past that. And women today, although not, I personally don't believe that I'm very much a feminist, and I don't think that we are in any kind of equality between the sexes yet.
No,
but women
no,
do
no.
have rights. Women do have the ability to become educated, to do with themselves as they wish. I don't want to backtrack from that, but we need some kind of new replacement for kids not to be raising themselves. And that could include either a return to multi-generational families,
mm-hmm.
or multi-partner family constructions.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know where we were going to go here, did you?
You lost me with polygamy, but that's if it were a situation where it wasn't polygamy, but it was just a self-constructed family of husbands and wives who were brothers and sisters to other husbands and wives, constructed, not biological. I could go with that.
Okay, fair enough. And we're not going to solve that particular issue today. But I do think that this plays into the breakdown of community that we're seeing. And I think that the breakdown of community that we're seeing is a long-term threat to civilization itself.
Yeah,
and
you could be right.
And having our heads stuck in our smartphones is definitely a part of this. Because your point, your agreed. Original point, was that people are getting to know people that aren't close to them, aren't geographically close to them, and that the reality is that online communities are being formed. And
yes.
The question is whether or not that's any kind of a substitution for any kind of a geographical community. And we don't,
yeah.
the jury's out on that, right?
Yeah, the jury is out on that. You know, it's not something that sociologists or anthropologists are going to be able to study in any detail for years to come.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that's viewed through the lens of history, not through
the lens of the present.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
And so the question is, and we mentioned this on TDO, but we both completely reject the premise that this is that smartphone addiction is a problem for Apple. Because it's not.
Right.
It's, if anything, smartphone addiction means more device sales for all the manufacturers, because this isn't just an iPhone problem.
No, it's not. It's never been just an iPhone problem.
But iPhone leads to pack.
Right. But, I mean, it was – honestly, it was a CrackBerry problem when
– That's true.
Before the iPhone came out.
And that was for email, for goodness sake.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had BlackBerry Messenger.
True. But that was much more for business, not social.
Yeah.
I mean, people, I'm sure people used it socially.
Oh, yeah.
But they used it socially with their other business people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, until some jackwagon at the university decided to steal it, my wife and I both had BlackBerries, and we loved using BlackBerry Messenger because we weren't limited to 140 characters or 160 characters.
Right.
Because we were English majors and we had to use full words and not letters right. and acronyms.
Right.
No, but good old I days. Digress.
The good old days. So, yeah. But even though Apple benefits from smartphone addiction, the yep. reality is that Apple itself, and this is the part that we mentioned on TDO, but I think that it bears repeating.
Absolutely.
is
I know where you're going.
They said what I can't remember if it was Phil Schiller or Tim Cook. It might have been both, and it's been mentioned more than once. But one of the reasons why they wanted to make Apple Watch a thing is to free us from our smartphone screens.
Right. Absolutely. Because, you know, if you get an important text message that you can reply to with just one commonly used word or phrase, it's a lot faster to use your digital crown to find that phrase, tap on it, send it, than to pull out your iPhone, type it out, and then send it.
Well, it's also easier to triage your stuff, too.
That, too. Yeah.
I mean, all the time, throughout the day, if I'm not in front of a computer or an iPhone or an iPad, which, you know, admittedly isn't all that often, but whatevs. Mm-hmm. If I get a text message coming in, I'll lift my watch up. And the first thing you see is who the message is from. You don't see the message. This right. is how Apple Watch works. And this is how it's worked since, I think, at least watchOS 2, maybe even the original watchOS.
I think it was watchOS 1.
And you only see the message if you keep your arm up.
Right.
And if you don't, if you just put your arm down, the message isn't displayed. And you don't have to, you know, you're not going to do anything with it. And that allows for very, very quick triage of, do I need to actually deal with this? Of course, you know, right. to our broader discussion here, one could argue whether or not I should even be doing that. One could say that you know, dude, it's okay to not check out your stupid Twitter notifications or your incoming iMessages or anything else. It's okay for you to be disconnected a little bit.
But time and place,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I'm spending time with family, I put my phone on Do Not Disturb. And there are, I think, three people who can still reach me through Do Not Disturb. And that's only recent, since they added emergency bypass to iOS.
Right.
But to your point of triage, even when I'm at my desk, I'll use my watch to triage.
Right. Oh, really?
I will glance at my watch. If a text message comes in, I'll glance at my watch before I'll change windows on my Mac to messages. I'll see who it is.
Let me ask you this. When you're at your Mac, because you come from the world of Linux, were you a Windows user too?
Oh yeah. I was Linux and Windows.
Okay. So when you are switching an app, can you describe to me the physical process that you use to switch apps? There's a point.
Yeah. It depends. It depends on whether the app is open or hidden.
Okay.
If the app is open, I command tab.
Okay.
If it's not open, I move my trackball and click on it. But I check my watch first.
Huh. Okay. I ask because one thing that there's a big difference between Windows and Mac in that where Mac users use command and say tab or command C for copy or command V mm-hmm. for paste, Windows uses control. And the fingers that you use are different. Right? So if you're gonna copy paste something in Windows, most people are using their pinky for control.
No.
What do you use?
I always use my thumb.
How do you use your?
I have long fingers.
Well, I can reach it, but it's not very comfortable, and it's certainly not comfortable. It's not very comfortable for me if I'm going over to Control N for new.
Well, you know what? It's been so long. No, I would do two hands for that.
See, all right, so there's my point. And I noticed this a long time ago with the game Myth, not to be mistaken for Myst. This was one of Bungie's. Early games.
I remember it.
And Myth was cross-platform. because Bungie were huge Mac heads, and before Microsoft bought them, and that were
it was one of the few games that was actually available for the Mac and for Linux.
Wasn't available. Okay, fair enough. And
it wasn't available on Mac?
No, it was a Mac. Yeah, it was a Mac first game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then it came out for Windows too.
Okay.
But and there was also an online component, and this was long before there were even that was common. And what I found was that Windows users playing that game didn't use groups to command to be able to command units that were anywhere on the map. That's one of the things you could do with Myth. You could basically drag your mouse, click and drag to select multiple units, and then make a group out of them, and then from then on.
I think I used to do that in StarCraft too.
StarCraft allows you to do the exact same thing. Yeah, they're. Similar games.
Yeah.
Well, that's not true.
I never played Myth, but I played StarCraft and
the StarCraft and Warcraft were the same game, but in different settings. And then there were some of the combat aspects of Myth borrowed from some of that same stuff. Okay. So here's the deal: Windows users didn't tend to use groups, and Mac
How
users.
They demand-
Mac users did. They'd click. They double click because you could double click on the same troop on a given troop type, and it would automatically select all of those troops.
Oh, okay.
Right, or they would even just click and drag and select on the fly.
Well, and see, that's because in Windows
it was Control 1, Control 2.
We were used to double clicking.
Well, but it was also Control 1, Control 2, Control 3, Control 4.
Yeah,
which again is not a comfortable key combination. On the Mac, it's Command 1, Command 2, Command 3, Command 4.
And it is more comfortable.
And it's much more comfortable. And I noticed the same thing was true with from there. I noticed that the same thing was true with a lot of key combinations between Mac and Windows. So, you know, for one thing, there's the Microsoft never enforced system wide commands with apps.
Right.
Whereas Apple did. So on an Apple, you go, you know, Command A, always select all. Command S, always save. Command Q, always quit. Command W, always close. Command C and V, it's always copy paste. Command X is always going to be cut. Command Z is always going to be undo. Command B for bold. Well, Command N for new.
Control C and Control V and Control X were always cut, copy, and paste.
Yeah, that's true. Those were. But the rest of them were not enforced. And so Mac users tended to go for those keyboard shortcuts, whereas Windows users often use their mice to go to a menu and you know click the menu and then click the command that they wanted. And I noticed that it's just this very different mindset between those two camps for a long time.
Well, and see, because I was dual, both Windows and Linux, I was a keyboard junkie.
Hmm.
So if there was a keyboard shortcut, I learned it, and I used it.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
And to this day, I still find myself occasionally hitting Alt F1 to try to change to a different window. At a Linux console, Alt F1 changes to a different console.
I see, right. Right. All of which is to say that I'm not going to my watch when I'm sitting at my desk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to my watch for an iMessage. I'm going to the iMessage app. That's just the way I work. Boy, that was a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
That was a significant rabbit hole.
What were we talking about before?
We were talking about Apple itself.
Oh yeah,
seeing the problem of people being glued to their smartphones and wanting to change that.
Oh man, that topic was so 13, 15 ago, Eastern time.
Yeah, probably was. And we've actually been going on about this for a long time. The bottom line here is that Apple that we may I'm not convinced that the substitution of online communities and online interactions is necessarily a problem for civilization. I'm not convinced. It may be. I would even say it probably is, but I don't think that it's anything that's hard and fast, because every time we have had some kind of disruption with the way we communicate, with the way we get information, people have decried the imminent collapse of civilization.
Okay.
And every time we've gotten through it. And I don't see why this should be all that particularly different.
Well, I'm gonna say it like this. iPhones don't kill societies. People kill societies. Drop mic.
Wow. 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 All right. So in the meanwhile, there was some news coming from Apple today.
Okay.
And
that's a good thing for us, right?
Yeah, usually is a good thing for us. Yeah.
Yeah,
usually is. So Apple and GE, it's the kind of thing that I think that the most Apple watchers really aren't going to care about all that much, because it's sort of like enterprise-y, and worse, it's an industrial.
Oh, yeah. Related.
But this is Apple and GE announcing what amounts to a significant partnership. And there were two components of it. And the first component is that Apple is including an SDK within iOS for Predix, which is GE's platform for industrial Internet of Things stuff.
Right.
So, like, for instance, the example that Apple used in its press release, and this was a press release that was jointly developed by both companies, a wind turbine could send notifications to someone on their iPhone regarding its operations, like, you know, oh, look, my bearings are broken, or something like that, or so that's what industrial Internet of Things stuff means,
right?
A some kind of, like, an oil well that reports in on itself, or you know, some kind of manufacturing equipment in a factory could be reporting back, and it's connected via the internet, and they're calling that industrial Internet of Things.
Okay, the kind of stuff that used to be done solely by programmable logic boards,
yes,
can now be done by smart devices.
Yes, and GE has a platform already existing called Predix that is designed for this. And Apple is including a Predix SDK in iOS, and which is, you know, it's huge for GE, it's huge for Apple too. And then the last paragraph before the boilerplate, you know, Apple is a company that does these things and GE is another company that does these things. The very last paragraph before that is, oh yeah, and GE is going to move its workforce over to iPhone and iPad for mobile needs. And GE has a workforce of 330,000 people.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of folks. But more importantly to Apple,
that's a lot of iPhones and iPads.
More importantly to that, though, is GE works with all of the companies. They worked with militaries right. around the world. They work with governments around the world. They work with companies around the world.
Yeah.
And so with Predix being on iOS, being part of iOS, essentially, and GE itself moving its workforce over to iPhone and iPad, there's going to be a lot of ripple effects.
Yeah.
And then on the Mac side, GE has committed to offering Macs to its workforce.
Really?
Yes. And again, this was just like, you know, this is in the essentially the last paragraph of the press release.
Just like a tangent.
Yeah, it's like, oh, by the way.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah, by the way.
We're gonna rip out Windows and Android and replace it all with iOS and maybe macOS too.
Yeah, I would imagine there were probably still some BlackBerry units and Windows Phone units in GE's workforce.
You know what?
And maybe some Android stuff too.
Little known fact.
Yeah.
I live about 35 miles. No, not even 35. More like 25 miles from one of GE's plants.
Okay.
And I had a contact. He recently passed away at GE.
My condolences.
Yeah, thank you.
Related.
Yeah. He was an Apple guy.
Okay.
And a long time Apple guy. One of the reasons that I got as deep into Apple as I did was him and his son. He carried an iPhone at GE.
Oh, okay.
He did not have a BlackBerry.
Fair enough.
And he was a network admin.
Well, they're probably not. I mean, it's probably not like everyone, but there were. My original point was that there were probably some BlackBerry and some Windows devices there. If you look through, I went looking through past Predix related press releases, looking for some imagery I could use in our article covering the Apple announcement. And every time they showed an app, a Predix app on a mobile device, it was not an Apple device.
Interesting.
So like Windows tablets in particular was what I was seeing.
Huh.
So one way or another, I would call this a loss for Windows, a huge gain for Apple. But it's also a gain for GE because you know, they're getting an SDK built into iOS.
Yeah. I'm sure Microsoft didn't do that for them.
You know, Microsoft has always been really good about that sort of thing.
You think?
Yeah, Microsoft has always catered to what companies needed.
Oh, okay.
Always, yeah. Microsoft has been very, very good about catering to companies. But Windows Phone is gone.
Right.
And I don't know. I know that there are fans of Surface tablets out there. I happen to not be one of them.
I've never used one, so I can't speak to it.
So I don't know. It's a pretty big. It's a big deal for Apple. It's a big deal for GE. It will have ripple effects for Apple. I mean, you know, so far Apple's biggest foot in the door partnership for the enterprise space has been IBM.
Mm-hmm.
IBM and Apple have been working pretty closely together for years now when it comes to iOS. This is the same sort of relationship, it seems, but now taken into the world of industrial stuff. And GE is, you know, a big, massive player. They've got 330,000 employees. They are one of the major industrial players on the globe. So this is a pretty big deal for Apple.
Oh yeah, it's a huge deal for Apple. It's a huge win.
I'm the most excited, I think, about GE committing to offering Macs as choices because while Apple's not going to be selling 330,000 new Macs a year to GE, they're going to be selling more Macs, enough to maybe noticeable for Apple in terms of the Mac platform, which is obviously nowhere near as big as the iPhone platform.
Right. Well, and of course, in order for that to happen, we need to get some professional level Macs other than the iMac Pro.
Yeah. I wonder how many people, I wonder how many people at, GE would need anything more than an iMac Pro. Actually, I wonder how many people at GE would actually even need the iMac Pro.
I think a lot of the
engineers.
Yep.
And I mean the design teams were probably already, a lot of them were probably already using Macs, certainly.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, but they've got a lot of CAD stuff that they do and yeah, I don't know. It could be a noticeable thing for the Mac platform, and I'm always very excited about any kind of boost to the Mac platform. because you know, because Apple seems to have been ignoring it until this year.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know what? That worked out to be in my favor. Because it encouraged me to get back into Hackintosh.
Oh yeah, it's true. It's true.
So good old Valtor.
Good old Valtor. You can read about Valtor. We'll include. Why don't you shoot me a couple of links to some of your articles on Valtor?
I'll see what I can find.
And I'll include them in the show notes.
Sounds good.
Right. So, next topic. We have a third topic.
Okay.
I'm going to command tab over there and look at it again. Oh, yeah, that's right. You've been writing a lot on iPhone X. Sometimes erroneously called the iPhone X. But the iPhone X, you've been writing about how to do some of the things because there are some significant paradigm shifts.
Yeah, so it's really weird what Apple's done with the iPhone X.
Well, how do you like your iPhone X so far?
The simulator's great.
Oh, the simulator. I see. So what you've been doing for us is you've been digging your nose into exactly how things are supposed to work with the iPhone X.
Yep.
So that we can have all these articles ready for customers before they even get their hands on them.
Right. And I've been doing that through a combination of the simulator and also just poring over every little detail I can find from people who got those few minutes of precious time during the hands-on period after the keynote.
Excellent. Well, so first of all, thank you for your service. We appreciate it.
Not a problem.
And secondly, what are your thoughts so far on these paradigm shifts? Like, how's Apple doing this stuff?
You know, I don't know. It's really strange. Losing the home button doesn't bother me as much as the fact that key combinations that don't use the home button on the iPhone 8 are apparently not going to be the same on the iPhone 10.
So this is not what I anticipated talking about, but John Keat and I were talking last week on Pop.0 in between the profanity. We were talking about the problem of feature drift and the fact that Apple is not doing a good job of making new features ubiquitous across its product lines, even the individual models within the same product line. To it, Force Touch on iPhone. Like, you know, why don't we have Force Touch on iPad? Certainly on iPad Pro.
Sure.
You know, and so you don't know. There's a lot of times it's actually hard to get into the habit of using some of these new features. The Touch Bar would be another one, because it's not available.
It's everywhere. Not universal.
It's not universal, and so now you're talking about further splintering with iPhone X.
Yeah.
So I mean, describe some of that.
I mean, to me, iPhone X almost seems like it's an experiment for Apple.
Oh, I would agree with that. Yeah,
they're going to see. I mean, basically, they're going to run it up the flagpole and see who salutes. And judging by the suggested iPhone 8 sales numbers, either nobody's getting a new phone this year, or people are flocking to the iPhone 10 when it becomes available for pre-order. And you know, the things that are changing are just bizarre. You know, there's the buttons. You can't use a button combination to power off your iPhone anymore. You can't use a button combination to do a hard reset.
Well, how do you do it?
To do a hard reset. Oh, shoot. Now, that one, I believe there actually is a button combination for, but reboot. You shut down your phone from – you either shut down your phone from control settings – not control center, settings. you either go into settings general and choose shutdown and then turn it back on, or I described a way that you could use assistive touch to give yourself a restart button.
That's a kludge.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Whereas on the iPhone 8, I believe it's you press and hold the volume up and the side button at the same time. And the reason you can't do that on the iPhone 10 is because if you press and hold the side button on the iPhone 10, it activates Siri. But you know what really boggles me?
Wait, hold on, though. We don't know what would happen if you do both of those at the same time.
No, we don't.
The side button does do Siri, but what if it's the side button and something else? It may actually do the thing that we want it to do.
I can tell you that in my attempts to duplicate this in simulator, it has been a bucket of fail. Now, granted, simulator is a beta right now.
Right.
But
it doesn't have the physical hardware buttons.
Right.
So
right.
It may or may not be representative of what using the iPhone 10 will be like.
It has keyboard shortcuts to activate some of those physical buttons. So there's a keyboard shortcut to activate the side button.
Are you going to get an iPhone 10?
Yes, in February or March, assuming they're available.
Right. I'm going to order one the first night. First day that we can, that midnight usually when it goes on sale. And, you know, I'm hoping to be one of the lucky few who gets one in the first shipment. Won't know until it actually happens. So I can't wait to see all this stuff. But my fear is that Apple, this is going to be a case of Apple going too far to simplify the hardware device.
Yeah.
That eliminating the home button is going to end up being a mistake. That's my fear. Practically speaking, I have a not inconsiderable amount of faith that if Apple is going to do this, they figured out how to do it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Apple has a good track record of that.
I know, but so far it looks like their way of doing it is through hacks and workarounds.
No, Apple wouldn't be planning on you doing it with a workaround.
I hope not.
They would simply, I mean, if this ends up being a mistake, the mistake will be that for Apple, it was okay to, in the case of the feature we're just talking about, it's okay to make you go do this in a inconvenient way. It's okay to remove the fast hardware-based way of doing it and make you do it through software.
Right, right. And it may be that Apple is just taking the opinion of you don't need to reboot your iPhone.
Yeah, you're rebooting it wrong.
Yeah.
that is possible. And I'm willing to be this guinea pig. I'm willing to be one of the people who is taking part in Apple's extraordinarily expensive experiment.
Oh, I am too. The only reason I'm not getting one on opening day is because I'm still too far off from my 12 months with my AT&T Next plan.
Right. Right.
Can I talk about what really confuses me, though?
Yeah, please.
Why on God's green earth are they moving the clock?
Because there's a notch in the middle of the screen? That clock?
Well, yeah. I mean, they had to move it from the middle. But, okay, so not the clock, but the Wi-Fi meter, the signal meter. The clock is now on the left side, and your Wi-Fi and signal meter are on the right.
Why would they do that if they didn't do that on the other devices?
I don't know.
Feature drift, man. Feature drift. This is the sort of thing that Steve Jobs excelled at. Like when he would see something like this, he would immediately notice it and then freak out and yell at people and threaten their jobs or maybe fire some folks until it was fixed.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that, you know, we've talked about this off and on for a long time. This is one of the things that Apple doesn't have now that Steve is gone.
Do you think Tim Cook just doesn't have the attention to detail that Steve had?
No, I think no one's got the attention to detail that Steve had. No one.
Fair enough.
The epitome of that to me is the phone call that now I can't remember his name. I think it was Gupta. The Google executive who worked with Apple on its on Apple's iOS apps and Google's iOS apps.
Okay.
And this is before Google pooped all over Apple with Android. Uh-huh. And before Steve Jobs declared thermonuclear war on the company.
Right.
And so Steve calls up Mr. Gupta. I think that's who it was. And he was at Temple. And Steve obviously wasn't. And the guy took Steve's call because it was Steve. And Steve's right. Like, listen, next time I call you at Temple, just, you know, it'll wait. You don't need to take my call, which is probably not true. He probably would have been really pissy if the dude hadn't taken his call. But that's beside the point. Steve was complaining that the Google Maps icon, that the yellow in that icon was a couple of degrees off. It wasn't the right yellow.
Wow.
And he wasn't even complaining. He's like, you know, I was looking at this icon and I think it's off. I think it's off a couple of degrees. And I mean, that is like, who notices that?
Steve Jobs.
And with Steve passed away and gone, I mean, that kind of attention to detail, no one else has got it. I talked about, you were there at MacStock.
I was.
And I argued.
Good times.
It was a good event. And I argued in my presentation that Tim Cook essentially is might be the best CEO that Apple has ever had, and that he might be that he was much more of a big picture guy than Steve Jobs was.
Okay,
and of course, you know, those are fighting words for a lot of people. I don't think Tim could have. I don't know. That's actually a long discussion to have. My point here, though, is that there are things that I think Apple is doing under Tim, in particular the non-invasive glucose monitoring, mm-hmm. some of the stuff with cars, some of the stuff with some of the AR stuff, a lot of things that we've heard about but don't know any details about yet, that those right. are projects that it may have taken someone like Tim to work on. It may. But the flip side is we don't get this kind of attention to detail. And I think this feature drift that we're seeing is a big part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like if we're going to use Touch ID, every device should have Touch ID.
Right.
If we're going to use a touch bar, if Macs are going to use a touch bar, there should be a touch bar at least available on every Mac. So we should have a standalone mm-hmm. keyboard with the touch bar.
Yep.
So that I can use it with my iMac. If we're going to have a touch bar, we need to have a touch bar. If we're going to use Force Touch on iPhones, every iPhone needs to have Force Touch.
Right.
Every iPad needs to have Force Touch.
Oh, I agree.
And if we're going to lose the home button, then every iPhone and every iPad needs to lose the home button. It doesn't necessarily all have to happen in the same generation. It doesn't have to happen in the same year, but it needs to absolutely happen.
Yeah. I'm thinking back, and it was early on in my Apple days, but when Touch ID first came out, we had the splinter between Touch ID and non-Touch ID.
Right.
We had a splinter between 3D touch and non-3D touch.
Well, Touch ID was eventually brought to all shipping iOS devices.
But and Face ID will eventually come to all shipping iOS devices.
Probably.
If the experiment works.
Will it come to iPads? So Ming Chi Kuo, the analyst, I always forget who he works for. It may be Citi.
KGI Securities.
Thank you. Not Citi at all. Nope. He has said that it's coming to all iPhones, that Apple believes that it's a competitive advantage. But what I haven't heard is that it's coming to iPads.
Interesting. How far out is he looking, though?
2018. He says it'll come to the next generation of iPhones, that Apple believes it has a significant technological advantage with Face ID, an advantage that its competitors can't touch for years.
Okay.
So, but like I said, he hasn't said that it's going to be coming to iPad. And so are we going to have iPads with Touch ID and then iPhones with Face ID?
That's a good point.
I mean, I could kind of see that because maneuvering an iPad is a different experience than maneuvering an iPhone.
Than maneuvering a phone.
But now and we've got feature drift.
We do. And I think if, given his track record and his own attention to detail, I think you're right. I think there's going to be a serious feature drift there.
Well, I mean, it's possible he just hasn't focused on iPad. It's also
it's possible
that he hasn't mentioned it. It's possible that I mean, we don't know that iPads aren't going to have Face ID, but my question is, are they? Certainly iPads don't have Force Touch.
Right.
And we have the feature drift between iPad and iPhone with the way Control Center and App Switcher works too.
Yep.
And that's the kind of feature drift. Maybe that's a feature drift we can argue from the standpoint of Apple is allowing iPads to be iPads and iPhones to be iPhones, which there's certainly some potential benefit there. But
right.
I'm a huge fan of feature consistency between devices. And in many cases, even between iPhone, iOS, and macOS.
Sure.
Where possible. But we see coming out of Apple this drifting for all this stuff. I think that it's a sloppiness that Apple should find a way to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Here's something. Force Touch. I like Force Touch.
I do too. And 3D Touch.
3D Touch. Thank you. That's another thing. Yeah, why is it
3D Touch? Why is it called Force Touch on the watch, but 3D Touch on the phone?
Well, it's Force Touch on trackpad too.
Yeah.
Right? So they should bloody well have the same name. But
yeah, they should.
I don't use it very much on my iPhone because I don't have it on my iPad, and I don't think about using it on my iPad. And because I'm not thinking about using it on my iPad, I don't think about using it on iPhone. And when I do think about using it on my iPad, I try to use it without thinking about it.
And it doesn't work.
And nothing happens.
I think I remember seeing somewhere that the cost of the 3D Touch assembly was too prohibitive to incorporate it into an iPad.
Because the display is so much bigger.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. All right. Well, there we have it. We are actually out of time.
Oh, okay.
Who knew, right?
I know.
Thanks very much for filling in for Jeff, or filling in for me while I'm filling in for Jeff.
Yeah, it was a great time.
Indeed, indeed. And here is how we do this. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to add, comment on, question, whatever, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening, and feel free to follow me on Twitter at TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y.
And you can follow me at Clefmeister. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded for TMO. That's all for this week, folks.
Stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.